until the Supreme Court rules on the presidential immunity claims that arising out of a separate case. The trial over Trump's efforts to suppress a scandal ahead of the 2016 presidential election by falsifying business records to conceal hush money payments to a film actress is set to begin on 15th of April. It will be the first ever criminal trial of a former U.S. president. Meanwhile, the U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon rejected Trump's attempt to throw out the case charging he mishandled and illegally retained classified documents. Donald Trump had argued he was entitled to retain the documents under the Presidential Records Act. But Judge Eileen Cannon rejected this bid to toss the case on grounds the charges make no reference to the Presidential Records Act, nor do they rely on the statute for purposes of stating an offense. Her finding nonetheless leaves open the possibility for Trump to use the theory that he had legitimacy retaining the documents under the Presidential Records Act, setting her on a collision course with the Department of Justice's special counsel, Jack Smith, who has called the Presidential Records Act theory a fundamentally flawed legal premise and said he would appeal to a higher court if the judge recognizes the theory. Judge Eileen Cannon has slow-walked the case over Trump's illegal retention of classified documents, which FBI agents uncovered at Mar-a-Lago in August of 2022. Prosecutors hope to begin the trial in July, but Judge Eileen Cannon has not yet set a trial date, allowing Donald Trump to postpone filing pre-trial motions required for it to commence. That's a win for Trump, who has sought to delay his numerous prosecutions ahead of the 2024 presidential election. The American newspaper The Washington Post has also covered the same story and tells us more. The U.S. federal judge overseeing Donald Trump's prosecution on charges of retaining classified documents has denied his effort to have the case dismissed on the contention that the Presidential Records Act allowed him to transform them as personal property and possess them at his Mar-a-Lago club. The ruling by U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon was significant as it struck one of Trump's main defenses and suggested the case is headed to trial. Judge Eileen Cannon's three-page order rejecting Donald Trump's motion to dismiss rested on the fact that Trump's argument about the Presidential Records Act did not directly address the applicability of the Espionage Act, which he has been charged with violating, meaning it did not give her a basis to toss the case. But the order left open the possibility that Donald Trump could raise his Presidential Records Act theory as a defense at a trial, and the possibility that Judge Eileen Cannon could instruct the jury to credit Trump's theory in such a beneficial manner that it could potentially ensure Trump's acquittal. The way the jury might be directed has become a major source of anxiety for prosecutors in the Office of Special Counsel Jack Smith, after a judge last month ordered both sides to draft jury instructions envisioning two possibilities that gave extraordinary credit to Trump's defenses. Judge Eileen Cannon has asked Trump and prosecutors to each draft jury instructions, supposing it was true that Donald Trump had the power under the Presidential Records Act to turn any White House document into personal records, which would implicitly mean he was authorized to retain them. The authorization issue is key to the case because Donald Trump was indicted for unlawfully retaining national security materials under the Espionage Act. if Trump could show that he was somehow authorized to keep the documents at his home in Mar-a-Lago, it would preclude his prosecution. Even more crucial is if Judge Eileen Cannon actually uses such instructions at trial, because if that happens after the jury is sworn in, double jeopardy protections for Trump would kick in. If Trump is then acquitted, prosecutors would not be allowed to retry the case. The first scenario envisioned that it was up to the jury to decide whether prosecutors could show beyond a reasonable doubt that Donald Trump had not designated each classified documents he took to Mar-a-Lago as personal. The second scenario envisioned that Donald Trump had the sole authority to turn a document he came across as president into a personal record that he could keep. And the very fact that he took them with him to Mar-a-Lago meant it was a personal record. Prosecutors responded to Judge Eileen Cannon with a sharply worded 24-page filing recently that made clear they thought both scenarios were wrong under law, but indicated they could find a way to work with the first scenario, because proving the classified documents were not personal was feasible. But prosecutors wrote the second scenario was fatal to their case because it allowed Donald Trump to simply claim that all the classified documents seized at Mar-a-Lago were his personal property by virtue of taking them with him. And prosecutors would have no way to dispute that claim.
Midstream.
The Iranian capital Tehran witnessed on Friday the funeral procession of the seven Islamic Revolution Guard Corps members who were killed in an Israeli entity airstrike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus last Monday. The processions coincided with the international Al-Quds Day marches as Zionist speculations continue about Iran's potential response to this blatant attack. Thousands of participants in the funeral procession and International Al-Quds Day marches demanded revenge for the blood of those martyred in the consulate attack, including senior IRGC commander Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahidi. A large banner was raised during the procession with the phrase, "We will make the Zionists regret," which was echoed by Iran's leader of the revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, following the strike. According to official statements and discussions in the Iranian political and media environment, it appears that the Islamic Republic of Iran has decided to show a practical reaction to the recent Israeli entity attack, although it is not yet clear how or when it will be executed. While some expect Iran to target areas in the occupied territories from its own territory with long-range missiles, others speculated that the response would come from other countries in the region. Either way, according to Israeli entity media reports, political officials within the security establishment have already raised the alert level, particularly in the Air Force and missile defense systems, in response to what they refer to as an imminent retaliatory threat from Iran. So much so that the Israeli occupation army announced in a statement the intensification of reserve recruitment in the air defense system and the cancellation of soldiers' leaves in several military units during the weekend. Additionally, several local authorities in central occupied Palestine, including Tel Aviv, have considered announcing the opening of shelters as a precautionary measure. On Friday, Zionist Israeli War Minister Yoav Gallant conducted a multi-front assessment with Chief of Staff Herzi Halevi, Shin Bet Chief Ronen Bar, Mossad Head David Bernia, and the Director General of the Ministry of War, Eyal Zamir, along with other security officials. All eyes are currently on the Zionist home front as a state of alert has been declared in all Israeli entity embassies and diplomatic missions worldwide. Meanwhile, Channel 14 stated that there is an understanding between Zionist Israel and the Americans that the United States will defend the Israeli entity if necessary, using its military weapons in the Middle East, intercept attacks against it, and perhaps assist in a counterattack if necessary. Dream on. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In the aftermath of its attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus and the assassination of seven Iranian officials, including the commander of the Quds Force affiliated with the Iranian Revolution Guard Corps, Mohammad Reza Zahedi, Zionist Israel has raised the level of security alertness in anticipation of the potential Iranian response. This comes especially after escalating threats from leaders of the resistance axis in their speeches in commemoration for International Al-Quds Day. To discuss this issue with us from Sydney is Professor Tim Anderson, academic author and geopolitical analyst. Thanks a million for being with us, Tim. Now, Zionist newspaper, especially Yediot Ahronot, reported that seven Israeli entity embassies, including those in Bahrain, in Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, and Turkey, have been evacuated for fear of an Iranian retaliation to the assassination that they conducted in Damascus. Meanwhile, Channel 14, Zionist Channel 14, stated that amongst the possible scenarios of the Iranian retaliation and retaliatory attack on Israeli occupation army, it might be actually on the army inside of occupied Palestine rather than outside. Now, whichever the location that Iran will actually choose to do, how do you assess the current Israeli entity anxiety while they wait for the said retaliatory attack from Iran?
Thank you, Marwa. Yeah, nice to talk to you again. Look, of course, they're going to be paranoid. The criminals are always worried that the same thing is going to be done to them that they've done to other people. But in the case of Iran, of course, this is a much bigger power than the Israelis. They sometimes say the Israeli military is the most powerful in the region. It's not at all, unless you think they're going to access nuclear weapons and start using them, in which case they'll be finished too. So I think that they're worried about their embassies. They're worried about their military. They should be worried about their military because that's the most obvious target. I think that it's very unlikely that Iran is going to respond by killing, by attacking embassies in countries which are relatively friendly to Iran. I don't think they're going to employ that sort of tit for tat. They're not going to go and kill Israeli children either. It's much more likely. Maybe this is a little wishful thinking, but I think it's much more likely they're going to do something far more targeted, as indeed the resistance forces have been doing already. In other words, that they attack airfields, Israeli Air Force, army bases, for example. They're able to do that. We saw that with them, and this is the only precedent we really have, is the after the murder of Commander Soleimani, the attack on the Ayn al-Assad air base in Iraq, when they sent in some missiles, but gave some warning and allowed the North Americans to escape from that scenario. But at least it was a very powerful blow and a demonstration of force there. I suspect that the attacks being lined up will be against the Israeli military, which after all are the ones that have been committing crimes in Gaza, and most of the international community would applaud such a blow.
Well, Tim, we saw last week how the Israeli Occupation Army announced in a statement the intensification of a reserve recruitment for their air defense systems and the cancellation of the leaves for their Occupation Army soldiers in several of the military units during this current week, as they actually take out their brigades and units from Gaza, and they are not allowing them to go back home as well. We also know for sure that Iran will retaliate. This is what Iran, from the highest leadership to the public who demonstrated against these assassinations, demanded and required. How likely do you think this current tension will escalate into an all-out regional war if it happens?
Yes, I think you're right that the Iranian leadership and the military have committed themselves to retaliation. I think maybe there's some surprise and apprehension around the world by the fact that it hasn't happened immediately. That really simply says that they're considering it very carefully and they're not being rushed, and they're playing to the line that they've always said is, we're going to do it on our own terms, in our own time. We're not going to be rushed or provoked into it. That's what the Israeli leadership has been trying to do, of course, has been trying to provoke Iran into a response, a heavy response, which, of course, the Israelis are probably going to regret, because Iran has tremendous capacity to deliver a missile strike on very clear targets in occupied Palestine. In other words, they've got very fast ultrasonic missiles, and they're very targeted. So I think that the Israelis will regret inviting this. But the point of it is, and I think most analysts are agreeing on this, is that the Israelis are the one group in the region which wants escalation. They want the US in to support them, because they don't want to take on Iran by themselves. They couldn't do that at all. Whereas most of the other forces, to some extent the US, certainly Iran, even Hezbollah, which has been very targeted in its attacks there, have been trying to avoid escalation. Escalation is not going to be in favor of the civilians in the region at all, and escalation always introduces a level of uncertainty into things. No one knows how far it's going to go. So I think that there's always a risk of that escalation, and Iran is preparing for that, obviously, by the mobilization of air defenses there at the moment. Even the Russians have moved some forces down into the Syrian part of the unoccupied part of Syrian Jolan. The Israelis are panicking, really. There many civilians are leaving the country. Of course, their army is mobilizing them, but there's not much that they can do except sit in anxiety, or what's the expression in Lebanon, stand on one leg, basically waiting for that response to come. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that is a discipline in itself, really. I don't know exactly to what extent the Iranian threat is now affecting the remobilization of forces, the withdrawal of forces from Gaza, and some say it's because they're being remobilized for an assault on Rafah, but that's not clear as yet either. I think they're more concerned about Iran's response at the moment than the next step. Having said that, of course, Netanyahu is committed to another stage in Gaza, because as soon as this war is over, he's finished, really. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows that.
Well, Tim, it is no secret that the Zionist Israelis seek, with obviously a green light from the United States of America, to engage in a war of attrition with the Al-Quds force of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, and gradually eliminate its leaders, the way that we've been seeing how they were conducting these assassination operations. And now, will this anticipated Iranian retaliatory attack, which you spoke extensively about, it might be in a way that it contains Zionist Israel rather than escalates the show in West Asia. Would it be enough, though, to deter, in your opinion, to deter any further attempt for Zionist Israel to further assassinate high-level IRGC commanders?
I don't, and it depends on the extent of the attack. In itself, it may not, but it depends how far Iran goes. Of course, we have other forces. We have the Iraqi resistance, the Yemeni resistance, the Lebanese resistance. The Iraqi resistance, I believe, has already carried out some strikes on oil refineries in Haifa. They've been attacking airfields before that. So, in combination with those, the Iranian strikes, it depends on the extent of it, to which extent it's going to cripple the Israelis. I think they'll want to respond if they survive, or the extent of them that survives after this. But let's remember, the Israeli military is already seriously crippled after the resistance attacks from Gaza. Basically, they're relying on their international support. And that's, of course, the factor at play here. You know, to what extent are the Israelis going to be successful in drawing in outside support here to try and stave off being entirely crushed by resistance forces there. That's not entirely clear yet. I think it depends how extensive this, as the Iranian leader called it, the slap that's going to be delivered to the Israelis. I think a lot of us are hanging in anticipation to see how far this is going to go. And already, of course, it's having an impact on the Israelis, that they are bracing for it, and they are probably unlikely to launch a major new initiative in Gaza when this is still hanging over their heads.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Tim Anderson, professor from Sydney and academic author and geopolitical analyst, thanks a million for being with us to discuss this very pressing issue at the moment. And our hearts obviously go out to our brothers and sisters in Gaza. hoping for an imminent ceasefire for them. Ladies and gents, you can find Professor Tim Anderson on Twitter and on Telegram. You can follow him on Twitter at TimAnd2037. And you can find links to his books, especially about West Asia, very important knowledge that he is trying to educate the masses on, especially the Western masses. Thanks a million, Professor Tim Anderson. Now, ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we're going to talk about how Israel is trying to drag the United States of America into an all war with Iran.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The United States and Zionist Israel are attempting to drag Iran into a regional war against the backdrop of the genocide in Gaza. The occupation entity refuses to take responsibility for the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, which Tehran also blames on the United States of America. More details in the following report.
The Israeli occupation continues its relentless onslaught on Gaza, trapped in a vicious cycle amid increasing pressures and challenges from all sides. While U.S. pressures on the entity remain more rhetoric than action, the overall international climate is gradually shifting towards opposition to Zionist Israel's atrocities in its war on Gaza with each passing day. The last cycle Zionist Israel willfully dragged itself into is the Israeli enemy targeting of the Iranian consulate building in Damascus. This aggression represents the most dangerous escalation in the region since the Al-Aqsa flood. This strike will undoubtedly alter the calibrated rules of engagement largely observed by the axis of resistance in dealing with the significantly increasing Zionist provocations. However, these rules will inevitably change, especially as they are a reflection of developments on the ground. Despite the fact that the United States and Zionist Israel are attempting to drag Iran into a regional war against the backdrop of the genocide in Gaza, the strategic vision of the resistance axis can be summarized as attempting to avoid open confrontation with the Zionist entity at present, while preparing for the inevitable major battle with an enemy that only understands the language of strength. However, exercising restraint, or what we might call strategic patience, also has its limits and boundaries that must not be crossed. This means that patience cannot be extended to actions that compromise the dignity of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The attack on the Iranian consulate carries various political messages. It is akin to a direct assault on Iranian territory, as diplomatic premises are considered part of the state's territory according to the theory of territorial extension. Moreover, it constitutes a clear violation of international law, which Zionist Israel has consistently disregarded, believing that might makes right on the ground. Well, it doesn't. Just as Iran acted prudently in response to the assassination of martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani by the United States, it will do the same this time. Iran will not play into Zionist Israel's hands. Zionists want Iran's reaction to be in their favor, but the Islamic Republic of Iran will act with wisdom and rationality as it did during the past 6 months of the war on Gaza. Iran's response will be crafted so as not to give the Zionists a pretext for escalating the conflict. In the meantime, American and Zionist officials have been repeating that the Biden administration and the Israeli regime are extremely concerned that Iran is preparing for what they call an imminent attack, deliberately not mentioning it is merely a retaliation to the Zionist aggression on the consulate. U.S. website Axios even reported, citing Israeli entity officials, that Tel Aviv informed Washington that if Iran launches an attack on them from its territory in retaliation for the attack on its consulate in Syria, then it will face a strong Zionist response, and that will escalate the current conflict to a higher level. Well, we'll see soon if Zionist Israel will put its actions where its mouth is.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Gharawi, political analyst. Thanks a million for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, according to the Axios website, Tel Aviv told Washington that Iran will face a strong Israeli response, which will escalate the current conflict to a higher level. Now, if Iran launches an attack on Zionist Israel from its own territories in retaliation to the assassination of the IRGC commanders in its consulate in Syria, is this a way of telling the United States of America that Zionist Israel will for sure drag Washington into an open war with Iran very soon?
It is clear that the United States will not yield to what Netanyahu specifically seeks. I believe Netanyahu, in his aggression towards Damascus, tried to tell the world and the United States to save him because he is in real trouble. He is in trouble in the West Bank, Gaza, and in the occupied Palestinian territories. So, I think with this strike, Zionist Israel was telling the United States to come forth and find a solution to the predicament he's facing at this stage. Netanyahu meant to say, if you don't agree to the solution, then I'm going to escalate. Here, I am going and attacking the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Netanyahu is now under extreme pressure socially, politically, and militarily, both internally and from the occupation army, which is currently under extreme military and security pressure. So, in my personal opinion, this strike is the end of the war, not the beginning of it. If the Americans realistically now agree to enter into negotiations and put unprecedented pressure on Netanyahu, I believe things are heading towards a solution and de-escalation in the Gaza Strip. And if this happens, I believe that through the visits of the Iranian Foreign Minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, whether to Oman, Damascus, or Beirut, Iran is conveying messages to the American side through mediators that Iran is ready to consider at the moment postponing this retaliatory operation or revenge, call it what you will. But I believe Iran is ready to engage in negotiations in exchange for the resistance factions achieving everything they want on the negotiating table, and for there to be a decisive agreement for a complete ceasefire and the return of the displaced to their homes in the Gaza Strip.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, everyone is talking about the possibility of escalating the war into a regional one, but no one is actually talking about the possibility that Zionists might actually hold Netanyahu fully responsible and choose to oust him instead of going into an all-out war against the Islamic Republic of Iran when they know that Netanyahu is just trying to pick a fight with Iran in order to save his face when it comes to the day after in Gaza. How plausible do you think this specific scenario is?
I don't believe Netanyahu has the capacity, neither the security, nor political, nor the societal margins, to engage in such a war with Iran. I think this exhausted occupation army can't afford to enter into new wars. The weary Zionist society can't bear any more pressure either. The colonial settlers in the north and around Gaza are also fed up. All of this constitutes significant pressure. This is besides the pressing issue of the Zionist captives, which Netanyahu cannot dodge or maneuver around. I believe all the parties that stood by Netanyahu in his war on Gaza are tired and fed up with the lack of solution and goals in Gaza. The U.S. administration, under President Biden, and the European countries, all those who are defending Netanyahu now because of his actions in Damascus, can no longer stand by Netanyahu legally or politically in this matter. So, everyone is tired of this situation and this stalemate. So I believe everyone is pushing Netanyahu towards a solution. And no one will assist Netanyahu if he wants to go into a broad and comprehensive war against Iran. It's clear if there's a war on Iran, these fires will spread throughout the region and not remain limited to Iranian soil. So, no one is ready to enter into a new war after 3 years of the war in Ukraine. The global economy won't allow it, and the exhausted American economy won't allow it either. The Americans, who are preparing for upcoming elections, are in a situation that doesn't allow them to be dragged into such a war with Netanyahu. So, I believe even the Americans are not prepared to let Netanyahu engage in such a reckless war against Iran in this context.
Well, there's something that I really find a bit interesting to discuss, which is the demonization of Iran and its role in the region that emerged after the success of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which declared absolute hostility towards the United States of America and Zionist Israel. Now, this perspective has proven itself over time, bringing us back to those who are always doubting and skeptical about the role of Iran in the region. It's supposed to be a source of strength, especially for those specific Arabs who doubt the role of Iran, and not the other way around, considering that our enemy has become mutual and Iran is among the most enthusiastic in confronting it. And by doing so, it is helping the resistance in the region. Then why is it actually the other way around? Why is this hostility and demonization against the Islamic Republic of Iran?
I believe the Al-Aqsa flood and its aftermath, along with many other issues in the region, such as normalization and whatnot, have made things more transparent. The Islamic Republic now has more cards of power to say to all the collaborators, peoples, rulers, and countries, especially Arab and Islamic ones, here is Zionist Israel, with whom you have gone far in friendship, and in return, you have gone far in demonizing us Iranians in this context. Here is Zionist Israel, killing without restraint, displacing and destroying homes, hospitals, children and women. I believe what happened may have been beneficial to the stance taken by Iran and the axis of resistance towards this Israeli entity. Now, no one can say that this Israeli entity is carrying the flag of peace in this region. The flag of peace is not raised by committing massacres, arresting civilians, and burning hospitals and schools, as we saw in Gaza. I believe what happened constitutes a power card for Iran's position, its strategy, and its view towards the Israeli occupation entity. And this will naturally impact not only the peoples of this region, but also the global public opinion. The global public opinion now knows more about the Palestinian cause and knows who stands on the side of right and justice, and conversely, who is wrong and who is the oppressor and killer. I believe what we are seeing now in Europe, America, and in many countries of the world towards Zionist Israel, and this hostile or at least unsatisfied view with what is happening in Gaza. This strengthens Iran's position, reinforces Iran's power in presenting its strategy and vision towards the issues of the region, especially the Palestinian cause. This deepens further the position that Imam Khomeini portrayed after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, by saying that Zionist Israel is a cancerous gland. Now everyone is probing this cancerous gland in this region for its impact on the peoples of the region and its neighbors. No one is comfortable in this region because they have come to believe that the Israeli entity constitutes a source of concern for them. And this Israeli entity is dragging the Americans into channels which the U.S. would rather stay away from in this regard.
Well, Mr. Mohammed Ghadawi, geopolitical analyst, thanks a million for being with us to discuss this issue about how Zionist Israel is trying to drag the United States of America into an all-out open war with the Islamic Republic of Iran, but it's obviously unable to do so until this moment. Thanks a million for being with us. Now, ladies and gents, thank you, and Eid Mubarak to you, to your families, and especially to our brothers and sisters in occupied Palestine, namely those in Gaza, who have been killed, who have been displaced, who have lost their lives and their loved ones because of the Zionist Israeli genocidal tendencies to showing the world that it doesn't care about other human beings. Anyways, Eid Mubarak to you. We'll see you again next week. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Y in the limelight.
In the United States, the special counsel Jack Smith has pressed the U.S. Supreme Court to reject Donald Trump's claim that he's immune from criminal prosecution for attempting to overturn the results of the 2020 election. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Special counsel Jack Smith urged the Supreme Court on Monday, 8th of April, to reject former President Donald Trump's claim that he's entitled to sweeping immunity from federal prosecution, arguing that the former president's alleged efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election frustrates core constitutional provisions that protect democracy. In a court filing to the Supreme Court, Jack Smith and his team of prosecutors argued that Donald Trump asserts a novel and sweeping immunity from the criminal laws that all citizens must abide by, and said his alleged scheme to thwart the transfer of presidential power was outside the duties of his office. No presidential power at issue in this case entitles the president to claim immunity from the general federal criminal prohibitions supporting the charges. Fraud against the United States, obstruction of official proceedings, and denial of the right to vote, they wrote. The president's constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed does not entail a general right to violate them. The special counsel told the justices that there are layered safeguards when a criminal case is brought that provide assurance that prosecutions will be screened under rigorous standards and that no president need be chilled in fulfilling his responsibilities by the understanding that he is subject to prosecution if he commits federal crimes. He also argued that there is no evidence that Congress intended to exempt the president from federal criminal statutes. Jack Smith's filing lays out the arguments his office will make before the Supreme Court justices on 25th of April, when they convene to weigh Donald Trump's bid to bring an end to his federal prosecution in Washington, D.C. Trump submitted his opening brief last month, in which he urged the Supreme Court to find that former presidents are entitled to broad protections from criminal prosecutions for acts taken whilst in office. From 1789 to 2023, no former or current president faced criminal charges for his office acts, for good reason, Trump's lawyers argued in the court. The president cannot function, and the presidency itself cannot retain its vital independence if the president faces criminal prosecution for official acts once he leaves office. But in his filing to the court, the special counsel Jack Smith wrote, "The federal criminal law applies to the president," and called Trump's argument to the contrary a radical suggestion. The absence of any prosecutions of former presidents until this case does not reflect understanding that presidents are immune from criminal liability. It instead underscores the unprecedented nature of petitioners' alleged conduct, Jack Smith argued. Notably, prosecutors wrote that even if the High Court were to find that some immunity could be extended to a former president's official acts whilst in office, that would not preclude Donald Trump's prosecution. According to Jack Smith and his team, the allegations against Trump deal with private scheme with private actors to achieve a private end, petitioners' efforts to remain in power by fraud. The special counsel told the court that the alleged plan to overturn the outcome of the presidential election in 2020 is the paradigmatic example of conduct that should not be immunized, even if other conduct should be. The High Court is reviewing a ruling from a three-judge panel under Federal Appeals Court in Washington that found Donald Trump can be prosecuted for alleged attempts to thwart the transfer of presidential power after the 2020 election. The former president was charged last August with 4 counts relating to accusations he acted unlawfully in a bid to stay in office, and he has pleaded not guilty. A trial in the case before U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan was initially scheduled to begin last month, but proceedings have been paused since December as Donald Trump pursues appeals on the immunity matter. The case marks the first time the Supreme Court will consider whether a former president is immune from criminal liability for allegedly illegal acts committed whilst in office. It has in the past, though, found presidents are shielded from civil lawsuits stemming from conduct within the outer perimeter of their official duties. The question before the Supreme Court justices in the case concerning Trump is whether, and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office? Though the phrasing of the question indicates that the Supreme Court may not consider Donald Trump's argument that a former president can only be prosecuted if he's first impeached by the House and acquitted by the Senate, both Trump and Jack Smith addressed the assertion. Jack Smith told the court in his filing that the Constitution doesn't establish a rule requiring such action by Congress before a former president can be prosecuted. Jack Smith wrote, "Adopting Donald Trump's position would thwart the ordinary application of criminal law simply because Congress, in administering the political process of impeachment, did not see fit to impeach or to convict." The American newspaper The Daily Beast has also covered the same story. Special Counsel Jack Smith on Monday, 8th of April, pressed the U.S. Supreme Court to reject Donald Trump's claim that he's immune from criminal prosecution for attempting to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The special counsel's assertion that no person is above the law, including the president, was backed up in supplementary filings by retired military officials and former Republican lawmakers. In a friend of the court brief, a group of 19 retired four-star U.S. military generals and other retired high-ranking military officials called Donald Trump's argument contrary to the foundational principles of our democracy. They warned that a ruling in Donald Trump's favor would undermine a president's legal and moral authority to command military forces, as it would signal that they, but not he, must obey the rule of law. It would also, they said, threaten to inject chaos into military operations, as well as peaceful presidential transfers of power. The notion of such immunity, both as a general matter and also specifically in the context of the potential negation of election results, threatens to jeopardize our nation's security and international leadership, they said. Particularly in times like the present, when anti-democratic authoritarian regimes are on the rise throughout the world, such a threat is intolerable and dangerous. In another amicus brief, 13 former appointed and elected officials, including former representatives Tom Campbell, Republican of California, and Tom Coleman, Republican of Missouri, and former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, also a Republican, argued that siding against Jack Smith could encourage disgruntled future presidents to weaponize the military and other armed federal personnel to reverse election results that they didn't like. In their 66-page filing, Jack Smith prosecutors told the High Court that Donald Trump's novel and sweeping clutch for absolute immunity was not supported by any constitutional text, history, precedent, or policy considerations.
Rabbana.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
Rabbana, ya Rabbana, ya Rabbana, ya Hayyu, ya Qayyum, nawwir qalbana.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question that, you know, a lot of people ask. That question is related to taqlid or emulation. As you know, we are currently in the age of the greater occultation, which means that we are in an age in which we don't have access to the infallible Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. In this age, we have been asked to, when we want to know the answers to religious questions and the rulings regarding religious issues, we have been asked to refer to the religious scholars who are experts in the religious sciences. So the question we want to pose today is this: what are the conditions? Can we just emulate any and every person that we want, for example, in an issue? Or is there certain conditions for the person, the scholar who we are asked to emulate? And tied up to this is that, why is it even necessary for us to emulate such a person? Can we just, you know, come to our own conclusion regarding, you know, some problem and then just, you know, act upon it or not? Fortunately, we have a tradition narrated from the 11th Imam, Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam, in which he sets out certain conditions and stipulations for the person who we have been asked to emulate. Let's look at this tradition and hadith so that we can understand these conditions and stipulations for this person. In this hadith, Imam Hassan al-Askari, he says the following: whoever from amongst our jurists safeguards himself, فَأَمَّا مَنْ كَانَ مِنَ الْفُقَهَا. So first of all, he should be a faqih, meaning he should have knowledge of religion, he should have knowledge of Islamic jurisprudence and Islamic laws. Secondly, he should be صَائِنًا لِنَفْسِهِ. He should safeguard himself, he should protect himself from sin. The sin is not mentioned explicitly, but it's implicit here. Is protective of his religion. So the third condition is that he should, he should try to protect religion with this knowledge. حَافِظًا لِدِينِهِ. He should use the knowledge that he has been given to protect religion, right? Even if that's at the expense of his own security and his own safety. The fourth condition is that he should oppose his temptations. مُخَالِفًا عَلَى هَوَاهُ. If he's tempted, right, and he's put in a situation where he is tempted to sacrifice the truth in order to satisfy his own temptations and desires, he shouldn't do that. Next, he should be obedient to his master's command. مُطِيعًا لِأَمْرِ مَوْلَاهُ. Meaning he should obey the commands of God. So these are the conditions, and the Imam says, then the common people, فَلِلْأَوَامِ أَن يُقَلَّدُوهُ. The common people must emulate him. It's interesting to note that at the end of this tradition, the Imam, he says, and this is only applicable and true to some of our Shia jurists, not all of them. So the Imam, he kind of informs us that all these stipulations and conditions, they're so stringent and difficult that they cannot be found in every Shia scholar, right? They only are found in some of them. Obviously, it's obvious, right? All of these conditions, they're very difficult to materialize, and you know they cannot be, form and be true for every individual. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the conditions of the person who we have been asked to emulate in religious issues, in the light of the hadith of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy in the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Face to face.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya. This week, we have a special guest to discuss issues relating to Libya. We are honored to have with us here in the studio His Excellency Ali Juma Al-Obeidi, the Ambassador of Libya to Iran. Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador, for your time.
Thank you. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of God, I have to thank Press TV for this opportunity that has been provided for me to explain the Libyan stance regarding regional and international issues.
Let's start off with the Iran-Libya relations. What is the current status of ties between these two friendly countries?
Diplomatic relations between the two sides have developed immensely. They have reached levels that can only be described as outstanding, which is caused by various factors. The most prominent being the desire of the two countries to strengthen these alliances because developing positive relations between countries of the Islamic world makes them stronger and more resilient. During my time in Tehran, I worked on decreasing the sources of tension and developing relations in the interest of my country, Libya, and also the interest of the cordial Iran and the Arab and Islamic region in general.
Mr. Ambassador, nowadays countries are more inclined towards trade. Now, what is the current status of trade ties between Iran and Libya? Are there plans to boost ties in this regard?
Trade relations between the two countries are developing at a slow pace. This is not caused by the Libyan side, since we are open to developing economic relations with Iran, who are friendly. But the Iranian side has some hesitation, or what can be described as not daring to enter quickly and firmly into the Libyan market. We are a country emerging from a war. Therefore, anyone who does not secure their place economically with us will not find a foothold in the future. On that account, the brothers in Iran must be aware of this matter. It is worth noting that Libya is a country rich in diverse economic opportunities. It's possible for Iran, which possesses experience and development in many fields, to summon up Iranian businessmen who will find many job opportunities, starting with medium investments that do not require large capital, all the way to strategic investments, which Libya desperately needs.
I understand you have written a book, and this book is about relations between Arab countries and Iran. Can you tell us more about this book which you have written?
This book was published in 2023 and talks about the relations between Iran and some Arab countries such as Iraq, Syria, Saudi Arabia and Palestine. I have divided the relations into two parts, the Shah's era and after the Islamic Revolution.
When you presented your credentials to Iran's President Raisi, he said that the problems of Libya and some Islamic countries are caused by the presence of interference of foreigners. What's your opinion on this point?
Certainly, the presence of foreigners in our region is not welcome. It is a source of anxiety and tension. But what is the alternative? This question must be posed to all active forces in the region. These forces must conduct rounds of dialogue and understanding amongst themselves to prevent foreigners from interfering. There is a proverb that says, the people of Mecca know best about its paths. The people of the Arab and Islamic region know best how to resolve their conflicts, which is contingent on direct understandings and the diffusal of any tension in the region. For example, we in Libya, despite all the religious, social, political, and cultural rapprochement with our neighbors in the ocean, have some disagreements, let alone countries that are somewhat different in many aspects. Therefore, this matter must be taken into account and understood. Disputes are resolved with understanding, not by postponing them.
Mr. Ambassador, let's move on to the situation inside Libya. Now, many in Africa love Libya and hope to see a lasting peace and stability in this country. Now, what is the state of politics in terms of creating conditions for holding national elections and forming an inclusive government which will bring together all Libyans?
Libyan history testifies that Libya was a place of friendship with the African and Arab surroundings. It was looking for calm in Africa because it is a continent rich in human and material resources. As for the political conditions in the country, right now, the various Libyan parties, and I will not describe them as conflicting ones since the conflict is over, thank God, now there are only differences of opinion. Thus, the differences between the two sides began to be resolved, and the groundwork for holding elections is beginning to take shape, but the realization of this depends on the seriousness of the Libyan political parties.
Now, Mr. Ambassador, there's been talk about uniting the rival factions in Tobruk and Tripoli. Can we expect good news in the near future regarding this?
Yes, we will see positive news in this subject in the near future. The ice of differences between the two sides began to melt, especially after the Derna disaster and how the Libyan people and politicians in the country came to help. They forgot their differences and past pains.
Okay, thank you for that, Mr. Ambassador. Now, let's move on to the issue of Palestine, which you know right now is the number one issue in the world. In Libya, we have seen, has voiced support to the measures taken by the International Court of Justice to prevent genocide in Gaza Strip through the case presented by South Africa. Now, can you tell us what your country is doing to ensure that the Israeli regime complies with this ruling by the ICJ?
Our country and most Arab, Islamic and even international countries do not have authority over the Israeli occupation to prevent it from committing crimes and make it comply with international rulings. This entity has been evading United Nations resolutions since the year 1948, but our country can use its relations with foreign countries to push them to taking measures and steps against the occupying entity to comply with the decisions of the International Court and stop its crimes.
Thank you for that. Now, Mr. Ambassador, Libya's High State Council has called for cutting ties with those backing the Israeli regime in its war on Gaza. Now, and the council has also called for halting of oil exports to countries supporting the Israeli offensive on Gaza. Now, has Libya taken any specific step in this regard?
Sayyid Mubarak,
never think that the Libyan state calls for something and does not do it. What distinguishes the Libyan state throughout the ages is that it does not compromise, it commands righteousness and implements it. We must know that Libya, from a practical standpoint, is in a state of complete hostility with the occupying entity, and its citizens are denied any form of recognition and the normalization of its citizens and its official and unofficial institutions is not permitted.
So Libya is totally opposed to the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime.
Our position is clear, government and people included. We are against this entity and the normalization of it and anything that distracts from the rights of the Palestinian people. By the way, Libya has always been in favor of free causes and with the rights of the people to decide their fate and to stop the injustice against them, whether in occupied Palestine, in Africa, or even in South America.
Libya is always in the news mostly because of also illegal immigrants coming from Africa and using the Libyan Mediterranean coast to enter Europe. I'm sure this is an enormous challenge for Libya. How is your country handling this issue?
First, I must clarify an important point, which is Libya does not take a single dollar from any European country to prevent immigration or put an end to it, unlike many countries in the world that take money for this, even indirectly, such as aid and things like that nature. As for the subject of illegal immigration, we have been suffering from it for decades. It's a major challenge for our country because whoever sets foot in it does so illegally and exits the same way, and therefore this is a major security and economic challenge. Libya has played an important role in reducing illegal immigration by developing